Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
And let's do accounts. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Ah, it's always so easy with just two people.
It is. It is.
And imagine how easy it would be with one person, you know?
Just you could just count to 10. You could just count.
Maybe we should just have a show with one person. I don't know.
I count to 10 by myself all the time. I'm really good at it.
All the time. Welcome back to Kotaku Split Screen, the only podcast that isn't set in a post-apocalyptic wasteland. Yet. It's May 16th, 2019, and I'm finally playing the Phoenix Wright games, the perfect follow-up to Danganronpa. Too bad Jason isn't here to talk about that. His wisdom tooth demanded otherwise. Meanwhile, Kirk is playing Rage 2, a classic shoot stuff in a post-apocalypse game. There's a little Destiny and tabletop talk before we get to the news, like that Final Fantasy VII teaser and our own anxieties about which games might be stealing our data. In Off Topic, we talk about Patrick Rothfuss books for a surprisingly long time before Kirk's music pick of the week. Let's get to it! And welcome back to Kotaku Split Screen. I'm Maddie Myers, and I'm here, as always, with Kirk Hamilton. Hello, Kirk.
Hello, Maddie. It's nice to see you.
It's nice to see you, too. But you know who isn't here is Jason Schreier.
Who isn't here?
I know. It's hard to even remember, but ordinarily there's another person on the show. It's Jason. Yeah. But he's having his own episode of Teeth Talk, our hit new podcast, alone in his apartment post-wisdom tooth removal. So I'm sure he's enjoying that.
I would just like to say that I would 100% listen to a drugged Jason Schreier talking like solo.
I don't know why he didn't agree to be on the show. It would have been really fun. And
I know.
He could have had a bunch of cotton in his mouth. We wouldn't have necessarily been able to understand anything he was saying. It would have been great. It would have been
an
episode
for the
ages.
I would have just trolled him with like bad opinions about Suikoden and then had him be like, no, that's right, you can't catch the whole time.
Yeah, that would have been great. I could have been like, I'm finally playing Phoenix Wright and I despise it. And I could have just talked about that. That would be a lie though. I'm playing it and I like it.
Could have worked. Okay. Well, so in honor of Jason not being here, or maybe because Jason isn't here, I went ahead and scoured the internet for some content that I wanted to share with you, Maddie.
Content. Okay.
What I did was I Googled gamer jokes, and I have looked up a few video game jokes that I would like to share with you. Are you ready for a couple of gamer jokes?
I don't know that I ever will be, but you're going to tell me them. So
okay, here
we go. I'm bracing myself.
First question. What is Samus's favorite food?
I don't know. What is it?
Metroid Prime Rib.
Nope. Nope.
Okay,
that
wait.
Sucks.
I got another one. Okay, you ready? What does a gorilla wear to the beach?
How is this a gamer joke?
A donkey thong.
No. No.
Yes.
No.
Yes, that's what a gorilla wears to the beach, Maddie. Okay, one more. One more. Are you ready?
Okay.
Which video game system is always late for school?
I don't know.
The Atari.
Okay, great.
It's tardy for school.
I got it. Yeah, I got it.
Do you get it? I don't know. Do you get it?
Would I feel like the structure of these jokes could just as easily be transformed into like pirate jokes. Like, what's a pirate's favorite console? The Atari. Like, it's like you just find puns that have to do with a video game thing and they have nothing to do with being a gamer. And what I'm saying is that these are great jokes and that they should be said constantly and they're perfect for gamers and gamers.
I will
love them.
Say that Googling gamer jokes turned up a lot of terrible jokes. A lot of like
these were the best ones.
Oh, these are the best ones. There are a lot of like shitty, problematic, sexist, etc. jokes as well. You will be shocked to hear. So I did some culling and I only picked the best ones.
The three
to read on
best
the show.
Possible jokes. I mean I didn't care for them, but I guess I didn't see what the rejected jokes were, so I don't know what I'm missing. And if I did, I would understand how great those three three jokes are. Thanks. Thanks for this.
You're welcome. Hopefully our listeners appreciated it. So cool. Before we get going, I wanted to go through a few emails we got, just some, a sort of a listener comment section. So let's do that. First of all, we got a few emails from, I think, three different people emailed us about forced arbitration, since we discussed that last week with regard to Riot Games employees doing a walkout in protest of arbitration, like aspects of forced arbitration in their own work. And two listeners, Richard and McCool, both wrote in to point out that something we didn't mention when talking about forced arbitration was the fact that a lot of arbitration clauses in the contracts that employees sign up, you know, when you sign your contract at work, also exclude you from doing class action lawsuits or from signing on to a class action lawsuit. And they both pointed out that there was a Supreme Court decision that supported this, basically, that said that that is not unconstitutional, even though it strikes me as kind of unconstitutional. But
yeah,
hey, you know, this is
which you had said on the episode last week.
Right.
But so, unfortunately, it's fine.
Right. The arbiter of what is constitutional apparently says that it's fine.
Cool.
Super. That's great. And so as to why a class action lawsuit is useful, listener Adam also wrote in, and he kind of put it this way. This is Adam. He said, "One critical feature of arbitration clauses is that they effectively and sometimes explicitly prohibit class actions. This means that survivors of harassment and discrimination at Riot can't band together and make a systemic class and attract the best lawyers. Instead, they have to find and pay lawyers separately, file separate cases, and win them, which is a huge burden on the employees. It allows Riot to avoid a case that truly challenges the pattern and practice of harassment." So that's basically it. It keeps you from all banding together, which, of course, everyone has probably seen talk of class action lawsuits. Think about Aaron Brockovich. That was a class action lawsuit in that movie.
The most recent season of How to Get Away with Murder, which is all about the class action lawsuit that the main character is putting together.
Right, that was the more current.
I think that's in the previous season as well, yeah.
Okay, that was a more current reference than Aaron Brockovich. A Steven
I
Soderbergh
love that
movie
show.
From like...
I've also seen Aaron Brockovich, but maybe other people have also watched How to Get Away with Murder.
So that is, I think, a worthwhile thing to keep in mind when thinking about this, and a bummer decision, in my opinion, by the Supreme Court.
Definitely.
Adam, who wrote that, also wrote us a letter about something else related to that article we talked about. Maddie, maybe you want to read this one?
Yeah, I'm going to read it. So cool. Adam writes, "I was very happy that you and Josh Rivera covered the issue of PTSD and working on violent media. This is a hugely important and underreported issue. I can relate, though in a different context. I founded and ran a human rights organization called the New Media Advocacy Project for about 8 years. NMAP helps human rights lawyers integrate video and multimedia storytelling in their advocacy, everything from evidence presentations in litigation to public education about arcane legal concepts. If you want to get inspired and depressed, there are several hundred really interesting videos on the archive of the site. Long story short, we all spent lots of time editing short videos involving prison conditions, torture, forced disappearance, gender-based violence, and I and some of my colleagues just got slammed by trauma symptoms. Similar stuff to what was reported in the Mortal Kombat 11 story. We would fly into a place, shoot some video for a few days, then come home to our super comfortable upper middle class lives. But the editing process of watching those shots, those testimonies of grieving loved ones, or images of violence over and over again, it just takes a huge toll. I really feel for those Mortal Kombat 11 devs. In particular, we learned of the importance of human connection as a key component of trauma resilience and recovery. The Dart Center for Journalism and Trauma at Columbia does amazing research on this. It turns out that journalists and media makers are vulnerable because they don't see the impact of their work with survivors of violence play out. They tend to cover the violence at a moment in time, then move on. I imagine that this disengagement from human experience is even worse for the folks making Mortal Kombat 11 cinematics or fatality animations. As you mentioned, they are working off of real images of real people suffering."
Yeah. Thanks, Adam, for sharing that. I thought that was interesting. And I think we can put a couple links to the New Media Advocacy Project. He links to a couple of those things. We can put those in show notes, maybe. But
yeah. I can also say I agree with at least one part of what he mentions at the very end there, where I've certainly covered stories about abuse or harassment, and you usually don't get to find out what happened in the end of it. And that's just sort of an interesting layer to our job sometimes. Well, not your job anymore, but it can also be very draining to research and write those kinds of stories. And usually I need a day of not doing that anymore and not thinking about it anymore after I've done one. But I
I mean, there are people whose entire job it is to write about that. And I have so much respect for them. And I can only imagine how difficult it is to do that kind of work all the time. It's a lot.
Yeah, I've heard that, I think, in some of the union negotiations at various media companies where that's been a thing that's been on the table is basically like mandatory time off after you report on something like that. Like, especially if you're a reporter covering a school shooting or something, you actually go out there and talk to the parents of kids who were murdered. And then, like, it's like you don't have a choice. You just have to take a couple of days off or, you know, maybe get some counseling. So working that in and finding a way to support people in that. This whole conversation, this was something I thought of when we were talking about it before. When we first talked about Josh Rivera's article, this made me think also about some Casey Newton reporting that I'd seen at The Verge about Facebook's contract moderators, which was a similar thing.
Yes.
And this sort of invisible labor force at Facebook of contract workers who are, you know, on contract salaries, so not paid that well. Mm-hmm. And their whole job is to just moderate content. So they're just looking at like murder videos from, you know, war zones and stuff, and also just horrible harassment and horrible things all day, every day. That's just what they do. I can't remember. There was some horrible term even for the rooms where they work. I can't remember what it was now. It was something like the meat factory or the slaughterhouse or something. And man, I think I just saw that Facebook increased wages for all of their contract employees, something like that, or they were forced to. But that kind of work is an increasing kind of work that more and more people are doing. And I guess it is, it's nice that more people are talking about it and just to hear more about it personally and think about it.
And
more.
That discussion of unions is becoming more and more of a thing culturally, mm-hmm. like across industries. Like, obviously, it's more of a discussion in journalism, but I think it's, you know, it's leaked out to the rest of the tech sector, certainly games. So, like, the idea of having those protections and being like, you have to give people vacations and you have to, like, make sure that they know what mental health professionals are covered under their insurance. Like, those are the kinds of things that unions can at least pressure an employer into doing or strongly encourage an employer to do.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's like an aspect of unions that we don't always think about. I talked about this, the Michael Pollan book, How to Change Your Mind, that I finished. And a big running through line of that book, which is about psychedelic research, and a lot of that is like research into dealing with trauma and addiction, and how he comes back to this again and again, but so many mental health professionals will basically say, we don't know what we're doing. We're not really like achieving outcomes like other health fields.
We don't know what a brain is. No one does. No one's ever heard of a brain.
Right, and we're not doing enough research, and we're not taking care of people enough. And as these, I think when people think about unions, they think, oh, unions go and try to get better wages and better time off and stuff. But actually, giving people the like a platform to argue for them, for like their company they work for, to take care of their mental health is an interesting and important thing that just kind of reflects the overall growth in us taking mental health seriously, since like depression is a massive problem and no one is really and the people have not figured out how to treat
how it
as well as
too,
they figure out how to treat other things. So it's good to see people talking about it, companies hopefully starting to take it seriously, and if they don't, employees working together to make companies take it seriously. So that's nice to see. Well, let's talk about some video games on that note.
All right.
we've been playing. It's kind of a light period for games, I guess. But I've played some things. I know you've played some things. What are you playing these days?
It's a good time to play some games that came out 1,000 years ago.
It is. It kind of is.
Catching up on my backlog. So Jason's not even here, but I've been playing the Phoenix Wright trilogy on my Switch.
Nice.
And
nice.
I'm enjoying it so much. Originally, I was like going to do what Jason said that I recommended that I should do, which is play a chapter of Phoenix Wright and then play a chapter of Danganronpa 2. But I'm enjoying Phoenix Wright so much that I've just continued playing the first few chapters.
Nice.
And it's so funny. I'm like laughing out loud at this video game that is 14 years old. I was not expecting it to be as funny and charming as it is. I was expecting it to have some similar problems to Danganronpa, which controls really poorly. And like, you guys will remember me complaining about how the controls in that game still feel like the game was made in 2010, which it was. And Phoenix Wright has been ported like, I don't know, 697 times to different devices. At this point, the controls on that game are great. And I more or less understand what I'm supposed to do. And a lot of it is very similar to Danganronpa. So like, you are questioning people and you still have to figure out which exact thing they say that you need to respond to, which is not always easy to figure out. And also, you're looking at rooms and pointing your cursor at things to highlight them in order to quote unquote investigate what it is about those objects that you need to notice. And then that may or may not produce valuable information for you later. And Danganronpa has those same kinds of mechanics. I think in Phoenix Wright, it's easier because you don't also have the weird first person shooter mechanics of the courtroom. Like in Danganronpa, mm-hmm. you have to like actually also time when you direct statements at certain people and have the statements be the correct statements. So in addition mm-hmm. to being a brute force guessing game, it's also like a reaction time thing that I usually had to repeat over and over before I would finally like do it right. And that's yeah. kind of how the game expects you to play it too, which is strange. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's mainly just had me thinking a lot about how mystery games are designed and how none of them ever really quite feel like you're actually having a conversation with somebody who's a suspect or solving a mystery or in a courtroom or any of the things that you are actually supposed to be doing. But they're clearly trying to emulate that feeling and the feeling of putting together clues and presenting a statement wherein mm-hmm. you have found something out. But every now and then you're in a position where you're like, I think I actually have figured this thing out, but there isn't yet an option for me to say that I've figured yeah. it out. And so I need yeah. to like guess what the next thing is that I'm supposed to say in order to trigger the third mm-hmm. thing that I know I'm going to get to. And that's mm-hmm. just a funny brain trap that both games have had me end up in. And mm-hmm. I don't actually know if that's a solvable design problem or not, but I'm curious what you think about it.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's definitely happened to me as well. The feeling of, okay, I know who did it and I know how they did it and I've picked up enough clues, but the game is requiring me to fill in the blanks, which is like a show your work kind of a thing. Like if you're yeah. really good at math and you know the answer, but you don't actually even know how you know the answer, you don't want to show your work. And they make you show your work, and then sometimes showing your work is where the stupid logic leap is, the one that's impossible.
Right.
Or, you know, because sometimes Phoenix Wright especially, like there are just logic leaps that are ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And when that happens, it feels like frustrating. It's kind of like, I know the answer. I know where we're going. I don't know exactly how to get there. And you right. wind up kind of scumming
it. Or like
it.
In my case, I'll sometimes select the wrong piece of evidence that proves the thing that I know that I need to prove. But it'll mm-hmm. be like, no, that
oh, yeah,
doesn't
do that
prove anything.
Time.
And I'll be like, but it does. And I know what I'm trying to prove mm-hmm. here. And I just mm-hmm. need to select apparently this other piece of very similar mm-hmm. evidence that also shows this. Sure.
Yeah, I almost feel like later games get better at that. Like if it's the person threw a statue and they threw it through the window mm-hmm. and it's like, what piece of evidence contradicts this testimony? And you pick the window and you were supposed to pick the statue and the window right. is just wrong. Like that can be very frustrating. That
yeah,
kind of feeling.
Yeah.
I feel like as they go, maybe they got better at making it so that all the things that you could pick any of the things and have them
right.
work. Maybe they did
and
that
they
from
would
the beginning.
Kind of get the idea of what you were mm-hmm. supposed to do. I was thinking about this a lot with oh, what was the name of that game? Oh, Oberdin, that we were all playing, where
oh, yeah,
you can kind
yeah.
of brute force some of the answers, mm-hmm. but also that brute forcing is at times part of the game. And yeah. in order to complete each mystery, you end up with this like pleasant game noise in all these games that's like, you completed mm-hmm. the mystery or clue, and like you selected the correct clue and got to a certain point, and you can do that by brute forcing it, and you find out from that feedback within the game whether or not it's correct. And mm-hmm. I was also thinking in playing this game about how real life is literally never that way, and actually when you are in a courtroom even, you are still just like, well, we're pretty sure this is what happened, but human memory is faulty, and mm-hmm. we think this is the right outcome, but like our legal system is super fucked up, so like who knows, we're all just really hoping that this is correct. Mm-hmm. And the game kind of gets at that by being like, you know, sometimes people are going to lie to Phoenix Wright, and he has to figure out like, and human memory is faulty, and they're maybe not intentionally lying. Like they introduced that concept pretty early on, and I was like, that's mm-hmm. kind of cool. But there's still always a correct answer that he can get to because it's a video game, and that inherently is just more satisfying to play than any real mystery right. ever possibly could be. But I also was like, could you make a game where you're never really entirely sure if you guessed the right answer on a mystery? Like, I think you could. It would just be really weird.
I almost feel like it would need to have a jury, or you'd have to be judged by other human beings
right.
to add that level of ambiguity where it isn't the game telling you, you did this mm-hmm. correct. It's like other people, you know, and so then your flawed argument might carry the day, or your perfect argument that gets all the right answers might not. And that kind of gets at the capriciousness of like an actual courtroom experience.
Yeah, and I think it would also be fun if more of the characters' statements contradicted each other slightly, because mm-hmm. that is usually the case. And so then right. even you would be leaving the case being like, there were still some holes here, and this is sort of disturbing to me, and I don't know whether I selected the right thing, but I'm pretty sure I did. I just think that would be interesting. But that isn't the kind of game this is. It's very satisfying. Everything has like a very pat answer, and that mm-hmm. can be a fun type of a game to play in its own way.
It is. So you've been talking, I read your article today about Phoenix Wright, and Jason's been talking about it, you've been talking about it. It feels like everyone's talking about it, I guess, because
everybody's talking about Phoenix Wright.
And I've played it a couple times, and just going back and like listening to the music again. So the music in this game is by Masakazu Sugimori, who is amazing. I forget this sometimes. I recorded a version of Maya Fey's theme music. I made this special cover of
cool.
it. This was almost 10 years ago. I recorded this like all instrumental version of like Turnabout Sisters, it's called. And it's such a good piece of music. I went back and listened to the cover
and then
listened to the original. It's so much fun, and the music in that game is so good. And it's been making me think about the aesthetic difference between Danganronpa and Phoenix Wright, because Danganronpa, we talked about this when you were finishing Danganronpa, it has this like great narrative to it, and the overall through line, to me at least, is more compelling. But Phoenix Wright is so memeable and catchy, and the character designs are so... I don't know. They have this certain thing going. Between the character design, the music, the visual aesthetics, the animations, the catchphrases, all of it, that kind of works as a broader context, I guess, on its
own. Yeah, I mean, it's funnier in a different way. Like, Danganronpa has a lot of dark humor that's sort of based on characters that you slowly get to know, whereas Phoenix Wright has more of the shorthand of this character has this collection of attributes. They need to be established very quickly, and so they're just going to tell jokes according to what you expect of this character visually, and that's just how the game works, because there's so many different new cases.
But, right, and new characters.
Right, but also, like, the music of Danganronpa is necessarily so much more ominous, and like it has all these industrial beats in there along with the techno and stuff, and you feel really tense, but also like you're totally rocking out. And in Phoenix Wright, like, it's gonna be a little funnier and lighthearted because that's the tone of that game. So I don't know, I think they're both great soundtracks, but also you're listening to a lot of music in both cases because you have to investigate an entire room. So it's got to be good music. Otherwise, the games suck ass.
Well, and both games don't have constant voice acting for everything. So, you know, the music dominates the soundtrack. Phoenix Wright also, I do think the Phoenix Wright music, like the one that's like, that plays whenever something happens. Or when things escalate in the courtroom, they have a couple of themes that kind of go beyond what Danganronpa typically does. Danganronpa has a couple in the courtroom when you interrupt, and then there's that sort of techno drop that happens when you're explaining the truth. That's really cool. But Phoenix Wright's thing is, I think, on an even more mimetic level. Just, you always hear this same thing of music every time this one specific thing happens.
And you see the, like, comic book letter explosion every time you do certain things, which, like, Danganronpa does that kind of shit, too. It's just, like,
it does a different
font. I don't know. Yeah. They're so similar.
No, that's
well,
true.
Well, the font matters.
It does.
They're so similar and yet also different. I mean, also, like, Phoenix Wright is about adults who aren't trapped in a horrifying situation.
The narrative context is significantly different.
Whereas Danganronpa is like everybody's goth and stressed out because they're teenagers and they're also trapped in like a murder cave, but mostly they're teenagers and they're horny and sad, and like that's a big part of everything that motivates them in a way it just isn't in Phoenix Wright.
I don't know, though, a lot of characters in Phoenix Wright kind of act like teenagers and seem horny and sad.
Looking forward to it.
Oh, man. What else are you playing?
Oh, I don't know. I'm still playing Pokemon. I have nothing interesting to say about it. I don't know why I'm still playing it, but it just, it's still just a part of my existence at this point, and I am enjoying playing Pokemon. I'm back to, like, playing Pokemon Let's Go because I still want to be able to combine my Pokemon Go knowledge and accruance of Pokemon into this game, but I don't think I'm at that level yet, and I also genuinely don't think it's going to matter if I can even do that. I don't think it's going to make the game better. I don't think it's going to have any effect at all, and all of this is meaningless. So I don't know, but I will say that, like, playing the game with other people, Pokemon Go, it continues to just be fun. And we can talk about this more in the news section, because we're going to talk about, like, privacy in games. And I've been thinking a lot about that with Pokemon Go and just the weird real life interactions that you can have with people in a game like this that involves going to physical locations. I don't know. Like, I've already heard like stories from my friends about like how raids can be very irritating and people can be rude to each other, but also you can make friends at raids. And like, there are all these different ways that people can turn out to be dicks at a Pokemon Go raid. Like, you can just go there and be like, I'm refusing to play with these people. And like, I'm going to go take my friends and go off in this corner and like play with my actual friends. And no, I don't want any of the strangers' help. Like, people can do things like that at Pokemon Go raids. It's just like,
do you physically have to go off with your friends to like a physical location?
Well, yeah, it's like physical locations, the game. Funny. So right. I don't know. It's just, I'm learning about all these new ways that humans can be great and terrible by playing a video game. And I really thought I had unlocked them all by playing so many competitive games over the course of my life. Like, I've played Counter-Strike at LANs, and I've played fighting games for a really long time. Like, I've seen people be dicks in all different kinds of ways at in-person video game contexts. But Pokemon Go introduces this new level of ways for people to either turn out to be really cool or just be really awkward or be dicks to each other. And that's interesting and funny to me.
Nice, nice. Have you seen Detective Pikachu yet?
Yes,
by the way?
That's in you my off-topic section.
Okay, is that, maybe we can talk about it. Is that off-topic? That's not off-topic.
I guess not.
Oh, it's in your off-topic. You put it there. Okay, I want to hear how it is. We'll do that in off-topic.
It's a movie,
then.
So who
we'll have
knows?
A little bit of Pokemon in every
section.
It's
also kind of a video game, but yeah.
Right, right. That doesn't surprise me. Well, what am I playing? Let's see. So I played some Rage 2. It sure is a video game. Rage 2. Man, you shoot people in a post-apocalyptic wasteland with guns that you gradually level up.
Wow.
It's pretty fun. I don't know. So Rage 2 is Avalanche and id, I guess, working together. I feel like Avalanche was the primary developer of this. It's a sequel to Rage, which I barely played, the id shooter from forever ago that wasn't very good. And it, like I said, you it's a first-person shooter. You get cool powers. It's a little like, it's got it's just one of those games that has a bunch of other games in it. So it's kind of Borderlands meets Resistance, Fall of Man, maybe, meets Doom, meets like Gears of War / those Unreal Tournament games, like Bulletstorm. It's got some Bulletstorm to it. It's kind of zany and funny, like Bulletstorm, or Borderlands, I guess, for that matter. But it's also, it is not remarkable looking in any way. It is pretty fun. The shooting, running around and shooting people is fun.
Tried and true video game.
Yes, tried and true video game thing. The world is boring. The story seems dumb. It runs great and looks good. It's fun. It's like very much in the vein of some of the things we said about Days Gone. And then even Days Gone, we were comparing to Mad Max, which was made by Avalanche. And also it feels a lot like that because you're driving around a post-apocalyptic world and like upgrading your car and getting cooler guns and stuff. And so I'll play some more. It's a little odd because Destiny, which I'll talk about in a second, I'm also playing, and that's like kind of the really good feeling PC first person shooter.
Right.
And Rage just, it's another one, and it's also fun, and it does feel like as good as Destiny at times to play, which is a feat. But I don't know how many of those I really need in my life. Like, one feels sufficient.
Yeah, I've heard the Rage 2 story is pretty short, so you could probably just go ahead and knock it out, which is more than can be said of Days Gone. But
that's
I don't
true.
Know
that game is just very long. They're very different in some ways. It's funny that they're the two AAA big games of the moment because they're so similar and so different. They're kind of the two sides of the coin, though. The Doom versus the Far Cry, right? The fast moving jump around mobility shooter versus the survival sneaking stealth thing. And they, the one that feels really good to play and the one that maybe feels less good but is more strategic. And that's what we got. We get the two post-apocalyptic kind of generic recycled seeming games, but it is pretty fun. I feel it's kind of a sale game. I feel like most people, if you like first person shooters, this thing is going to be $10 on Steam.
Cool, yeah.
In like a month. So that's probably my buyer's advice. Not that I do that often. So I played some of that. I've played some Destiny 2. They're getting ready for their new season in Destiny 2, which will like add a new level cap and a new raid, which is exciting, and some other stuff. And we talked about this some last week, Jason and I did. There's a new exotic quest for this gun, Outbreak Perfected, which is the Destiny 2 version of a Destiny 1 gun. They've been doing this a lot, where they just take a gun from the first game and make a big hullabaloo about bringing it back into the sequel. And this gun was a really cool one in the first one because it was the gun that we did that whole Secret Hunters of Destiny episode. A big part of the middle of that was talking about the hunt for Outbreak Prime, which involved all this wild math and spreadsheets and crowdsourced stuff. So Outbreak Perfected is not the same. You find some hidden stuff. Then you do a really hard time trial that's sort of like the Whisper of the Worm quest, where you have to like run through this really crazy labyrinth and there's all this platforming. It's really cool. And some friends helped me through it last night. We beat it, got the guns. Basically the same gun from the first game. It's really good. It's cool.
Cool.
And then there's now all the exotic guns in Destiny have what's called a catalyst, which is like a thing you install on it that maybe you have to kill a bunch of things with it to get it powered up. And then once it's powered up, it adds some new ability. So it's kind of the optional ultra grind thing for the really hardcore people. If they want to make their favorite rocket launcher, like do something cooler, they can go get the catalyst. So the catalyst is like for hardcore people. The catalyst for Outbreak Perfected is this totally wild thing that requires multiple weeks of going through a heroic version of the same mission.
Oh boy.
And it's nuts. I've been reading about it. They've been solving these puzzles. There's a new puzzle that it introduces. It changes a whole bunch from the regular version of the mission. There's like this floor maze that you have to go through. I was looking at these matrixes online of people figuring out all these numbers and stuff that are on the wall. And it was very original Outbreak Prime and really cool. And just makes me, it's amazing when game developers like hit that perfect level where they're crowdsourcing and counting on the players to figure out some outlandish thing, because you know if you put something hard in a game, they'll like solve it in a day or in an hour, and then you'll be like, wow.
Yeah, but really, what if you make something longer that requires a bunch of spreadsheets to be uploaded
exactly
to Reddit? That's the perfect thing to add to a video game.
And really, it kind of is for this. Yeah, it's always exciting and
kidding.
Fun. And even like
it rules.
I get my friends to carry me through this stuff and I don't solve it myself, but watching people like Datto, who we've had on the show, people like that solve this stuff is really cool. And it's funny because there was an earlier thing that Bungie tried to do. I think it was like Niobe Labs is what it was called. And it was so hard that this no one solved it. And they had to just open the door and kind of say, oh, all right, our bad. This was just too hard.
Yeah.
And so it seems like so far this one has been a good middle ground. Like it's not too hard. People are solving it. But it's been fun to kind of watch that, even though I haven't even done that. So that was neat. I played a tabletop game called Sheriff of Nottingham. Do you know this game?
I don't, but I am familiar with Robin Hood as a character, so go
yeah,
on.
Yeah, Robin Hood's not in this one.
Too
so,
bad.
But it's the Robin Hood cinematic universe.
Right.
And so this game is really, really fun. It's a bluffing game. It doesn't take too long to play. Pretty simple. And the way it works is we played with four people. You're all merchants and you're trying to take your wares to the market.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have a deck of cards and you have a hand, and in your hand is like some legal wares, you know, bread and cheese, and then some contraband. So each round, one person is the Sheriff of Nottingham, and you hand around that Sheriff of Nottingham like figure, and each of you takes a turn. So the one player is the Sheriff of Nottingham. You go two times around and that's it, short game. And then the way it works is everybody else, you just put a number of cards in your little pouch and you snap your pouch closed. And then you give the sheriff your pouch and you say, oh, sheriff, in here are three pieces of cheese. And then the sheriff, of course, you can try to tell if you're lying.
Mm-hmm.
They can look at what you picked up the last round and try to guess. And then you can try to bribe them and anything goes. You can bribe the sheriff to open someone else's pouch, or you can promise future things. I think you can bribe stuff that isn't even in the game, and you're trying to get the most stuff scored away, like, you know, sold in your market and then
right,
save the most money.
Of course.
Hilarious, extremely fun game, highly recommended.
Can you win if you're the sheriff, or are you just like the cop that round and you can't necessarily win?
You get points if you search someone's bag and they have contraband, so
mm-hmm.
you can
So there is an outcome where the sheriff wins and like the merchants have all failed in some way.
Yeah,
to
the
do
perfect
the thing they
yeah, like
do.
A perfect play would be for the sheriff to search only the pouches that have contraband and to
right.
let the ones without contraband go through, because if you search one without contraband, you get penalized. So
okay.
you have to play smart, and you can try to like trick the sheriff into picking yours when you know there's no contraband, which I did a couple times. It was very fun. It's just a very like it's one of those games where you'll all be laughing a lot and like hating each other, but in a really fun way, and it's very lighthearted, and
yeah,
I enjoyed
it.
So
great.
That's called Sheriff of Nottingham. There are apparently a million expansions too, really fun. And then I played a little bit more AC Odyssey, but I don't really have anything else to say about it. I just sort of played a little
good
bit
game
more.
You know,
yeah,
just a good video
pretty.
Game
it's super pretty. So yeah, I'm a fan of that as well. Well, why don't we take a break and come back to talk about some news?
Yeah.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
Hey, Maddie.
Hey, Kirk.
What do you call the Nintendo Wii in France?
Oh, no, it's the fourth best gamer joke that can be found on the internet. I only like the top three gamer jokes. I won't stand for this fourth one. Just kidding. I want to know. What do you call it?
A Nintendo Yes.
I don't think that works.
No.
I mean, I get it, but I don't think the structure of the joke works.
See, it's funny because we is what the French say.
I got
for
that
yes,
part.
Betty. So like we means yes, and so it's the Nintendo Yes.
I would say that joke is Nintendo no to me.
This is Nintendo mal.
No.
It's Nintendo merde.
C'est mal. Je déteste le joke.
One day we should do a whole podcast in like remedial French.
En français?
Mm-hmm. En français. Un peu. Je parle français un peu, mais pas très bien. I learned a little in high school, and that's all I really remember how to say.
Cool.
So in English, let's talk about some news. And there's not a ton of news. We have, I think, more of a topic that we want to talk about. But before that, it seems like there have been some announcements happening, some game trailers, some exciting hype, forward-looking type stuff.
The hype is building. It's not yet E3, but soon the trailers will converge upon us all, and we'll finally have something to talk about as gamers.
Right. So the first thing is the Final Fantasy VII Remake trailer, which I watched. What did you think of this trailer, Maddie?
I watched it. It brought me back to being in my friend's living room watching Advent Children a billion times and thinking about how freaking cool Advent Children looked and thinking about, oh, if only there were Final Fantasy games that looked as cool as Advent Children looks.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically what this game is purporting to be. It's not out yet, but it has that same look and style of that movie for anybody who even remembers watching that movie, which is not a good movie, by the way.
Man, you know, so I watched that movie because, so Lee Alexander, great writer, and I did this whole letter series on Final Fantasy VII a million years ago at Pace Magazine. Go look it up. It was great. It was really fun. And she's great and got me to play the game. Like she was the whole driving force. And she got me to watch Advent Children after we did that.
Cool. Yeah.
I can't remember if we ever, I don't think we published anything about it. We emailed about it some or something and watched it. And I just remember it was very like watching that movie after just having played Final Fantasy VII for the first time. It was very like, it was specifically, I wanted to see, if I were a kid, I would have thought, I want to see these characters done in a realistic style, doing awesome shit and like having huge fight scenes. And that was what that movie was.
It's also like a movie that makes absolutely no sense whatsoever if you haven't played Final Fantasy VII, and debatably makes no sense whatsoever even if you have played Final Fantasy VII.
I did, VII. And there's a lot in Final Fantasy VII, and I guess that raises the question that I guess is an interesting, I mean, no question that a trailer raises is that interesting, but just because trailers are
like
that
interesting. Especially like a 60-second trailer with almost nothing in it except cool images. But yeah, go on.
The question is sort of, is this going to actually be Final Fantasy VII, or is it going to be its own thing? Because it looks very different. I mean, the combat system, the whole thing. And I wonder, having played Final Fantasy VII from a sort of modern perspective, it was the first Final Fantasy game I really played all the way through. The game is so weird and sprawling. It goes in a billion different directions, and it's sort of, the game just becomes this ridiculous ridiculous, sprawling thing. And I kind of wonder if a remake could really do that again. Like, just have that much stuff and that many different things.
I mean, I think it could. I'm more just like, how much of it are they going to change? Because even from what little we've seen, it seems like some of the lines are going to be slightly different. Mm-hmm. So then it introduces this idea of, oh my God, there's so much content in that game that could potentially be slightly different. And how many times have people obsessed about what the content of Final Fantasy VII is? I mean, I've super enjoyed Tim Rogers' videos analyzing like the Japanese and English translations of the game. And like, even that, like, Tim could do a whole other video series just analyzing this freaking game and what will presumably be multiple translations of it, and comparisons between it and the original. Like, that just, there's a whole new genre of YouTube videos that can be made about this game, probably, because it probably will have key differences. And I don't know. I mean, there's also like parts of the game that don't necessarily hold up super well. Like, Gata wrote a story about the character Barrett, who's pretty, for the past several years, has been notorious as being like, you know, one of the only black characters in games in that time period, but also like a total stereotype. And like, are they going to change that character at all? Especially since his character wasn't that way in the original Japanese version of the game, and it was only that way in the English version. And like, that's interesting. And are they going to change, I don't know, anything else? Like the scene where Cloud cross-dresses, which is a completely famous scene, but is also a scene that has been fairly meaningful to a lot of queer people and been like, I played that part of the game and it like introduced thoughts I realized applied to me or whatever. So like, it's a weird place. It's one of these games that's old enough that people have all these associations with its original content that maybe that original content wasn't super great, but people have like these emotional responses to it existing. And so taking it out is kind of a weird thing, but also like, some of it's bad now. I don't know. It's a weird spot for a game to be in.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. I think it's fascinating that the context that the game existed in has taken on its own life.
Yes.
And then now we view it through that lens, and anything modern will be viewed through that lens, which gives them a lot of interesting opportunities to change and tweak and make it its own thing without, you know, just totally slavishly recreating the original thing. I don't know. I'm curious. I mean, I will 100% play it when it comes out in 2027 or whenever this thing is actually going to come out. But it was fun to just see a little bit more of it. And it looked good. I feel like it like you said, it looked like Advent Children. So,
which is good, maybe, if you're me and you wanted it to eventually look like that. Which I don't even know why I wanted that, or if it's something I actually want, or if it's just something that seemed like it should happen, and now it is. So,
and now it is. Cool. Finally, at long last. A couple other things that were announced. I'm just excited about the Monster Hunter World Ice expansion. I can't remember the specific name, but just, I want to play more Monster Hunter World. It seems like that'll be a good opportunity. There's been a ton of stuff in that game that I haven't seen still, just because that game never ends. But I do kind of miss playing it, because I got pretty good at it, and it was fun. Another thing that they announced was Ghost Recon Breakpoint, which is a very Kirk Hamilton game, because it's a Ubisoft, like, tactical shooter. I think this game sounds awesome, though, actually. Like, I know people, like, don't like Ghost Recon, and I definitely, like, understand and feel the same way with like the political critiques of Wildlands, like the fact that you were these Black Ops soldiers going into an actual country, Bolivia, that was portrayed as this overrun, you know, by drug cartels thing. Like, that bugged me. That said, I did really like Wildlands as a tactical shooter. Like, it was a thing that just the two things existed in my mind at the same time. Like, this is gross. But then when I'm in the middle of it, especially playing with a friend, it was like just really fun. And I was, you know, it kind of like separated the two things. But it's nice that the sequel will not require me to do that legwork. Like, it's okay. We just are going to some island, and some dude, or the Punisher, basically, John Barenthal, has like taken over this island, and there's drones everywhere. And now it's just a more generic thing. Fine with me. What I liked in the description of this game is that it sounds kind of like Metal Gear 3. The way they're describing it is you're solo, so you don't have AI dudes following you around like you did in the first game, which is fine with me, especially because the AI guys had terrible conversations and like they made really bad jokes to one another all the time, actually, come to think of it, which, as I'm sure
you can... But I thought you loved bad jokes based on this episode of the show. Why didn't you love that?
it was my favorite thing to hear their terrible
jokes. Cool, yeah. So you're really sad that this time you won't be hearing
any jokes
in your ear as you sneak around.
There were some details in there, just, I don't know, that you have to eat and drink water, and like there's kind of a survival aspect to it, and that
very
made me
Far
think
Cry
of Metal Gear 3.
Too. Cool. You get sick, Metal Gear.
And like sneaking, like camouflaging yourself. There's a whole camouflage system, and like having to eat and like survive. That makes me think of Metal Gear 3 in a cool way. And I already like how this series plays much more than The Division, which is like more like a weird Destiny meets, like this game is like an actual, like closer to Ghost Recon tactical game. Anyways, I thought it sounded kind of cool. I was surprised to think that, but reading about it, I was like, huh, I'm kind of excited about this. What do you know?
Cool.
And the other thing I'm excited about that I just thought I would mention is the No Man's Sky update that's coming this summer. Have you been following this at all?
Yeah, a little bit. I'm not a No Man's Sky person, but I get why you're excited about it.
It sounds cool. And the VR version of it looks crazy. Like, I have an Oculus Rift, and I haven't plugged that thing in a long time.
But I will get it out for this. You're going to go to space in VR.
Nope. Definitely. It does looks sound cool. Great. And it's like a fully fleshed out VR. I mean, we'll see what it actually is when it launches. But looking at the trailer for it, I was like, oh, this is fully designed to work in 3R. Like, anyway, that looks pretty cool, too. So some upcoming stuff that we can get excited about. Even if the games that are out right now are not that exciting.
Listen, Phoenix Wright is a great game and it's out now. So I don't know what you're talking about.
That's true. That's true. It is definitely out now.
Yep.
Okay, so we are now going to talk about privacy a little bit because I read this wonderful Vox article by Caitlin Tiffany. The headline is Angry Birds and the End of Privacy. We will definitely link to it in show notes. And it raised all kinds of questions for me that I've been chewing on in terms of privacy, but not really in terms of games and apps and our gameplay data. And I thought it was really interesting. So I want to start with just a prompt question for you, Maddie, that I'll then answer.
Okay, great. Privacy quiz.
We've done jokes. Now we're doing a quiz.
Cool.
So on a scale of like 1 to 10, 1 being not concerned at all, 10 being like hair on fire, concerned about it every day, where are you currently in terms of your concerns about your online privacy, just in general?
I'm pretty high at this point. It wasn't always this way. But at this point, I'd say I'm like a 7 or an 8, depending on how potentially controversial an article I have written recently or am working on. I mean, it's maybe a little lower now that I edit more than I write. When I was writing, it was higher because I was always worried about my safety. But also, this is such an open-ended question, and I think that some of it is like, well, in what way am I concerned about my privacy? Like, what actual actions am I taking in order to reflect that concern? Like, there was a period of time when I was anxious enough that I would keep a VPN on, like, almost all the time when I did anything. Like, I've gone through various phases of being concerned to a level that was slightly irrational about my privacy. And even now, I'm really play my cards close to my chest on the internet about like physical locations I'm in. And like, I don't really tweet names of people I know very often. Like, I'm a little bit of a weirdo about it. How are you when it comes to this sort of thing?
Yeah, I'm kind of an 8 too. And I would say it's, you know, I have never been, so during like after Gamergate 2015. So looking back 3 years ago, I think I was actually, that was when I first became concerned about privacy for the reasons that you're saying, because that was this period of time where we were all kind of the targets of this mob, and it was a lot worse for a lot of people than it was for me, but it was still that feeling of like, okay, I need to lock my shit down. I need to like really get secure for the first time. Now my concerns are still related to that. Like you said, yeah, I'm not specific about locations and that kind of thing. There's also just my general feeling about my data, which is such a broad statement. But I sort of think about that a lot more now than I used to. And really ever since the Cambridge Analytica Facebook scandal, where now I like am really, I think about my data a lot. Like, I think about what my phone is telling people a lot.
Me too.
And so I'm much more like an 8 or a 9 now, where I was like a 6 or a 7, even a couple years ago.
Yeah.
So this article is really interesting. I'll kind of paraphrase some of it. It starts talking about that, about just basically how privacy and our data and data control have become a thing that people care about a lot more. Like, basically in the wake of the 2016 election and Cambridge Analytica, and there all these scandals, the like cascading scandals at Facebook, as it's become clear that they were just selling your data right and left and your data was not your own. This article is actually about Angry Birds, or it uses Angry Birds. Tiffany uses Angry Birds as a starting point to sort of talk about the idea of these third-party apps on your phone. And they don't all have to be games, but they can be games. And the way that they have all of these advertising intermediaries built into the software, where you're, you know, you use the game and then all of this other software is kind of sharing your gameplay data with, could be a whole bunch of different people. Sometimes it's like Facebook or Twitter are getting it, or Google. And sometimes it's just these like you know, other companies that just sell advertising data to various other people, you know, we don't even really know who.
Yeah.
And it kind of just, it gets into this, the whole idea of device identifiers and tracking your device identifier across multiple apps. The idea that children are using these things and it's actually illegal for children to be tracked because of what's it called? The COPPA, is that it?
Yeah.
Yeah, the COPPA, Child Online Privacy Protection Act. The way that that actually isn't protecting anyone. It's a really good article. It covers a lot of ground. I've thought about a lot of this stuff, and I guess it left me thinking about specifically our gameplay data and the way that any game that we play, pretty much, we almost always agree to share our data, right? We say, oh yeah, it's always like, well, we want to make the game better. Will you share our data? And generally speaking, I'm guessing a lot of people just click yes because you think, well, whatever, what am I doing right now? I'm playing this video game.
Yeah.
But as we spend more time playing a game, and this is something that this Vox article lays out really well, actually, you can determine a lot about somebody, especially if it's a game like, you know, they're like Pokemon Go, a game that someone plays every single day, especially that. But or even like an MMO like Destiny, like if like Bungie can tell a lot of stuff about me. They can tell who I play with, who my friends are,
what times I play, you play. Yeah. Mm-hmm,
how many hours, what, you know, and even stuff about my play style and what that might say.
Do you
about
just
me.
Wander around aimlessly when you're playing at certain hours of the day? Like, how are you doing psychologically? That can all be determined from your play style, I guess. Spooky.
Right. And that there's at least a theory for that. And that is increasingly making me feel like all of this data is something that we're giving up so willingly. And I am starting to wonder if we're going to look back at this period of time, at the period of time where we all just assumed that our data wasn't our own because it
I feel
was
like
being
that's
generated.
Already happening. And I've experienced this with Pokemon Go. So like when I reinstalled this game to play it with my girlfriend, there's all these new options in the game that actually weren't there when I first played it. Like it was kind of a weird game even when I first played it. The entire game revolves around going to real life locations. And even at the time I was like, this is really weird, and there were some things that squicked me out about it the first time around. But the second time around, there's this adventure sync thing that you can do where it tracks your steps even when you're not playing the game, and the way that you get Pokemon to do anything in the game is that you have to walk around. Like, all of it is tied to a pedometer. That's how everything in the game is unlocked. So if you don't connect this pedometer to be on all the time, you'd have to open up the app every time you went for a walk. And like, also it's just pointless to do that because then you're just opening the game all the time anyway. So it always, always already knows where you're going and what your steps are. So you basically, like, in order to play this game and have it function the way it's supposed to function, you have to turn on these location services and give the game permission to like track your steps everywhere you go. I don't go that many locations. I work from home. I go to a track that's near my house and I run around the track. That's how most of my Pokemon are leveling up. I don't lead a very exciting life. But at the same time, I was super freaked out at the idea that I'd have to turn this on and that I'd have to like get back into this game by allowing it to have access to that data, even though like this is the excuse that everybody says, like that I just said, which is like, oh, my data isn't even very interesting. I don't do anything. I don't care if they know that I go to CVS multiple times a week or whatever and, you know, swipe on the Pokestop that's right outside of it. Like, that's fine if Pokemon Go knows that I do that. But like, I don't know. It's also super fucking weird. Like, I don't know if I want people to know how often I go to CVS. Like, and who is finding out? And like, what is that data being used for? I don't know the answer to that, and that makes me feel really nervous, but in an unspecified and slightly irrational way that I can't justify. Like, I can't even explain this neuroses. It's just like, you read Cambridge Analytica stories, you hear about the idea of your data not being your own anymore, and you're like, that fucking sucks, but I also want to participate in playing this game and like hanging out with my friends, and I want to log into Facebook and find out what's going on with people and like see pictures of their babies or whatever. But I am also having to just deal with this low level buzz of anxiety about the fact that anything that I do in these spaces is just up for grabs to the highest bidder. And it blows.
It's so related to the fact that it's so complicated and deliberately impossible to understand. Because I totally know that feeling you're describing. I feel the same way. The feeling of sort of helpless whatever, which for a long time was kind of how I would talk with Emily about having Amazon Alexa installed, which we used to have. And we would joke about it on the podcast. I would have to say Alexander because I couldn't say it. However, you'll notice I'm saying it now. And that's because we took them all out of our house quite a while ago. As a test starting, we were just like, let's, what if we unplugged them all and saw in a week, is our life any worse? Because mm-hmm. I'd read enough stories about all the things it's recording and the data that it's collecting.
Yeah.
And, you know, got rid of it. Okay. So Apple still, I'd have Siri turned on. Apple has been marketing the fact that your data is your own, despite, as this Vox article actually points out, profiting quite a bit off of the in-app purchase like percentage that they take from these apps that use your data in this way. Mm-hmm. It is interesting to me to see Apple going at people directly and saying, hey, everybody else steals your data, but we don't. We're your data is yours and we keep it pretty safe. And that, I feel like, is another sign that this is sort of changing, and that at least people are, at least they're willing to tell us that they understand that it matters enough to tell us that they're doing the right thing. Whether they are or not is sort of another question. It's so confusing. There's an amazing anecdote in this story where she basically calls Rovio and asks if, let me find what it specifically is. It's incredible. But asks, oh yeah, so are you using, you know, these, like the certain kind of adware, like ad intermediary in mm-hmm. your applications that are outside of the control of, you know, you or Apple? And they say, no, we're definitely not. And then she checks with a security consultant. The security consultant is like, I'm looking at their code right now, and they definitely are. There's like this and this and this. And so then she calls them back, and they revise their statement to something. It's like, oh, well, we prefer to use transparent connections, but that isn't always possible. And so the question is, were they misleading the reporter? Maybe the person just had no idea because it's so confusing and nobody knows. And it really makes you feel disempowered in a way that drives me nuts.
Yeah.
That makes me feel increasingly frustrated with the whole thing. And so I got off Facebook a few years ago. I feel really good about that. It really bothers me to know that probably Facebook controls data that comes through some of these apps on my phone anyways. And at this point is probably built enough of a profile of me based on like my phone's fingerprint and other things that they can still just know and keep tabs on me if they want. I don't like that feeling. And I think about, so this is a kind of a tangent, but so Uber just had an IPO, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is some other thing I read and I don't remember where I was reading this, but Uber's IPO didn't do that well because Uber isn't profitable, because these like ride sharing companies are like not actually profitable because their business model sort of doesn't work, and they're going to have to raise rates because they're so cheap. It just doesn't make sense. But someone was pointing out basically, okay, Uber's not making money, but there is something that Uber has that they could use to make money, and that's 10 years worth of data that they've accumulated off of everybody. Right. So everyone using Uber has been like telling where you're going and like where you're from and, you know, who you are, and kind of you can really determine so much about somebody. And so all these companies also can look at data, even if it wasn't their primary product. They can look at your data and think, well, there's another source of revenue. Sweet. It's like a mix of Angry Birds using your data to sell it to Facebook, so Facebook gives them more users to recommend the app to that are kind of match up with the data of the people who spend the most money. And then there's also the fact that any company would pay Rovio or whoever for the data because it's just valuable to them for any of a million reasons, which could be totally nefarious or totally benign. And man, it's a thing. It's a big thing, and it seems like a thing that more and more people are talking about. And I really do wonder if there will come a point, and I feel like this would almost have to be some sort of litigation or law that's passed, where you are given a bill of rights, like an online bill of rights that you control at least some percentage of your own data as enshrined by law. It just seems like this assumption that like, oh, well, I don't know, I use these things and I guess they just get all my shit. it seems like we will look back at that. I hope maybe that we will look back at that and think, that was such an ignorant
view. That was such a weird time when we just
didn't know
have
better.
Access to our own mm-hmm. data, or like didn't have rights to own our own data about where mm-hmm. we physically go in the world and what we do there. Yeah,
yeah,
it's really weird. It's a weird time, but I also feel like there are things that are public data that I didn't fully realize were public data until I started getting like targeted online for writing mm-hmm. about video games or whatever. Like, I didn't realize that addresses were so easy to get.
Oh, yeah.
Like, at this point, it's, I hope, very hard to find my address on the internet because of work I've done on my end to make that mm-hmm. the case. If I had done nothing, it would be very easy to find my address on the internet. And like, that's just a thing, and that's somehow legal and fine. So like, there's already data about me that is very available to anyone. But I hope that the data about how I play Pokemon Go is not available to anyone. But like, is there a dark future where it is available? Because like, the laws around those things are very strange to me. Like, I was really baffled several years ago when I realized that like, there aren't really laws about people putting right. your address on the internet. That's just not a that's not a thing that we have protection over. And it feels like it should be, but it doesn't. And so I guess it then also logically follows that we don't own our data in these apps. Like, why would we, unless somebody...
Well, right. If we agree to the terms of service, yeah, we gave them our data. Like, I think yeah. in those cases, the ship has sailed. It's more a question of
yeah.
could we do something in the future? So one thing that's happening is Ed Markley, who's a Democrat, and Josh Hawley, our friend Josh Hawley, who we
cool,
talked about
yeah,
last
our
week
bestie.
As well. So they've introduced bipartisan stuff to expand COPA and to try to like get this stuff to away from kids. It's that mm-hmm. same kids thing where the
right.
politicians kind of find a kids angle and they kind of hit that home.
Yeah, it seems like that maybe works a little better because like everyone can agree that we shouldn't be selling kids data, but like should we be selling anyone's data?
Right, that's the thing. That's the thing, right. Especially when the majority of us, I mean, this is something I don't even think about that much. And you and I talk about video games and technology all the time. Like I think about mm-hmm. this stuff probably more than the average person.
Yeah.
And I still don't understand how it works. And I'm kind of resigned to a lot of my data, especially from that period of time before I left Facebook and before
yeah.
I started turning off location services, just kind of being like someone just has an imprint of me from maybe 2008 to mm-hmm. 2018 or 2016.
It's just
or so.
Out
like,
there. Yeah.
And it'll exist forever and I can never get away from it. And the more I change, I actually feel like I want to become a totally different person, almost to spite people who think they can use my data to know me. You don't know me. I'm totally different now than I was, even though I'm sure I'm,
you
I'm
not.
You
hate jazz and, now, and you've never yeah. played the saxophone. Yeah.
Yeah. So that is all fascinating. So I feel like this is the first part of a longer thing. I think this is a really interesting topic. I would actually love to hear from listeners. I think we'd all love to hear
me
from
too,
listeners
yeah.
about this. If you work in security or you know things about privacy, or even if you just have your own thoughts about this, we'd love to hear from you. So shoot us an email at splitscreen@kotaku.com. And yeah, I feel like this is an important thing to talk about. So I want to know.
It is. It's a scary but important thing to talk
it
and
is.
Think about.
It's complicated and big and important, like most important things, I guess. And yeah, it's a lot. So yeah, we'll be interested to hear what you all think. All right, let's take another break and we'll be back for some off-topic conversation.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs. A gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Hey, Maddie.
Oh, no. What's up? What?
Why are cats so good at video games?
Because they use cat trollers?
That was a good guess.
Okay, that's not it.
Because they have 9 lives.
All right, fine, sure, good. That's great, too.
Cool. I'm glad you agree. I think it's great.
I love it. I love gamer jokes now.
Yeah, they're good. I think that was what we learned this episode, is that gamer jokes are fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about some off-topic things. Maddie, what have you been watching and or reading and or attending in the theater?
Oh, that'd be great if I'd been attending something in the theater. I haven't seen any theatrical productions in a long time, sadly, although I like them. So I finally finished watching all of Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. It's all on Netflix now. I love this show. I just had never gotten around to watching the final season of it for whatever reason. Did you watch this show when it was on?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I loved it. We had Rachel Bloom on the show. She was like famous guest. So, yeah.
Yeah.
I think, I don't know if Jason actually kept watching it, but I watched I loved the first season. I liked the second season. And then are there 4 seasons total?
Yes.
Is that right?
So you too could go back and watch the rest of it
on
Netflix.
I really want to, because I gather it ends strong and it's really good.
It does. It ends in an interesting way that I found mm-hmm. satisfying and cool.
Nice.
Yeah, I liked it. The fourth season is also, this isn't like a huge spoiler, but like there's this character who the main character dates in the very first season, and then that actor leaves the show and they can never get him back. And so in the fourth
yes.
season, they just eventually solve the problem by recasting the actor and like having the character return as this other actor. And then they have to like tell a bunch of jokes about that. And it kind of works. It would have been really great if they'd had the original actor, because he's so great, but the replacement guy is also good. So
yeah,
it's just like a thing about the fourth season that's really strange and funny, but the show itself breaks the fourth wall in so many ways that they kind of just force it to work in a way that only that show could do. So yeah, I enjoyed it.
Yeah, I feel like I heard there was drama or something. I'm looking him up. His name is Santino Fontana, who played Greg in the initial season, who's amazing. I thought he was so good and loved him as well and really missed him when he left.
Me too, yeah.
He was Hans in Frozen. He's like doing he's like a Broadway guy.
Yeah,
he
does a bunch of he's like stuff. Actually singing on the stage in the theater.
Yeah, yeah, he's doing the thing. But yeah, Settle For Me. And what's the song where he's just like, whatever, I don't care. Like, it's like a grunge song, and it's just him talking to the kid. He's like, so you got a baby. Cool, good for you. Like, the whole song is super good.
Yeah,
he's I could if I wanted to. Like, it's just him being a slacker.
Yeah. Yeah, I enjoyed season four, but I kept, like, going back and watching old videos of the previous actor, because I was just, every time I saw the actor imitating him, I would just be like, you're almost there, but you're not quite it. And then, like, to cleanse my palate, I'd have to go back and, like, look up an old Greg song and be like, yeah, that's what he sounds like. That's the character. Yeah. It was a really weird way to experience the season, but I know they were doing the best they could because they couldn't get this actor either for drama reasons or like, whatever, literal theatrical reasons. Drama reasons. Yeah.
Nice. Yeah, I'll watch the rest at some point, definitely, because I really, really like that show.
It's, yeah. And the other thing that I saw was Detective Pikachu. Nice. A movie that exists.
It sure does.
I enjoyed this movie. It is not deep. It is not making any grand statements at all. It is just a really fun movie that has a lot of live action Pokemon in it. And there are a lot of moments where, like, a live action Pokemon will be doing a thing and you'll be like, that's funny. Like, Squirtle's like helping firefighters put out a fire, and you'll like see a bunch of Squirtles and you're like, yeah, Squirtle's on the news for putting out a fire. That is what a Squirtle would do. It's like that, but like 600 times in the length of a movie. Mm-hmm. And it's really great. But I will also say that I made a small mistake when attending this film, which is that my girlfriend and I got there very early, which was not the mistake. We got there like 45 minutes early to see this movie, and we walked into the cinema and I looked at the screen, she didn't, and I saw the reveal of a character who only shows up at the very end of the film, and I was completely baffled by what I was seeing and didn't understand it and was like, I don't understand what I'm looking at. That's really weird. But then once I saw the entire movie, it all fell into place. I was like, oh, I'm kind of sad that I saw that. But
you got spoiled ahead of time.
It wasn't like being spoiled. It was more just I was like, what am I looking at? And then that image was in my head throughout the movie and then finally made sense at the end in a way that was kind of sad. So don't be me and don't walk into a movie and watch the end of it and then go back and watch the movie. Like, I don't know why that happened.
Like, you got there so early, you saw the end of it.
Yes, yes.
Oh, shit. Okay, I misunderstood. I thought it was like the trivia thing.
Literally, don't be an idiot and walk into a movie and watch the end of it and then walk out again and then expect that the movie will not be in some way slightly ruined for you.
I thought you were going to say that the mistake you made was that you went sober.
Well, honestly, going to see this movie high would probably be fun, but yeah, we didn't do that. We went sober.
Like, just went stone cold Pokemon fans.
I
am not a massive Pokemon fan. I like don't know all the deep cuts. I just know the main ones. I haven't really watched the movie, the animated movie or the show.
Sure.
I know the basics. Would I still get as much out of this movie, or is it really the primary thing that you see Squirtle?
I mean, a lot of it is funny. Look at this thing you recognize. That is what a lot of it is. Like, it's also a funny movie, but I would say the strength of almost all of it is contingent upon you caring about what Pokemon are fundamentally.
Right. Maybe more of a renter. Maybe more of a renter.
Maybe.
For me. I still haven't seen Us. I mean, I'm like way behind them.
I know, me too. I wanted to see it, but it looks really scary.
It does look kind of intense.
I'm a baby, so.
Yeah. No, I hear you. I'm with you.
Anyway, what have you been watching / reading?
So I've been watching / reading a few things. I think all of mine are watching. Maybe I'll do the short ones first. So I've been watching The Americans finally, finishing The Americans.
Cool.
Which I'm on the second to last season, and there's one more season. Have you watched this show?
I saw the first season, and then for no reason, I didn't continue.
Yeah, I can see that.
It's a good show.
Kind of it's a great show. It's a grueling show. And so I have had periods where I come and watch it, and then I'm like, woof, that's a lot. It's a fascinating show. It's kind of right now, especially because this isn't a major spoiler, but also this show's old at this point, but their oldest daughter finds out, and there's kind of a plot line where they're working with her and like explaining slowly, kind of just drawing her in and not telling her the full, you know, we murder people for the Russian government and we're really scary, but they start just being like, oh, we're like, you know, we're peaceful, we're diplomats, we're just not supposed to be here. And then gradually she starts to see what they're capable of. And
that's fun.
It is. It's
and
interesting.
By fun, I mean terrifying.
It is intense. And they're all great actors. God, the cast on the show is so good. And it's really kind of about how parents manipulate their kids, because like parents just do that. I mean, that's just part of being a parent. I know this only from watching my sister be a parent and watching my nieces grow up. But there's so much kind of manipulating your kids. And it's not like bad. That sounds bad when you say manipulating.
You're teaching them how to be people. And sometimes,
yeah, you tell them things and you don't tell them other things. And you kind of.
Sculpting is involved.
Yes. And so now they're kind of sculpting their daughter into being a spy, basically. And so it takes on a whole new thing, but it's still about that same fundamental type of action. So, anyways, I haven't finished. I'll have more thoughts when I finish. It's a great show. I started rewatching the Matrix trilogy.
Cool.
yeah. So I like just rewatch the Matrix sometimes, you know, because it's just an awesome movie.
Same.
And it's really
I rewatched
easy
it on
watch.
A plane
yeah.
recently. Great yeah. film. Great plane movie.
Yeah, and especially since I've seen the sort of critical reads of it as a trans narrative and that stuff, I think is so cool. And watching it, man, it makes that the best sequence for me in the whole trilogy. The best fight scene is Agent Smith versus Neo in the train. I mean, there's nothing more serious than that. And then knowing the backstory behind that is like, and all of just like what the train symbolizes and how intense that is. And like, man, that's really cool. An amazing movie. The sequel, so I'm midway through Matrix Reloaded. Cool. And like, I know everyone hates that movie and I don't even remember the third one, but I think I am going to watch it. Mm-hmm. It's kind of fun to watch the second one now in some ways and just to sort of, I don't know, reflect on how much time has passed and go into it with fewer preconceptions and not really care about the stuff that they're introducing. It's frustrating in a lot of ways because they just play so fast and loose with the rules of the Matrix and how anything works. There's just this feeling eventually that it's kind of like how Game of Thrones treats Magic 2, where it's just you never know what's going to happen and they throw new stuff on and then, oh, okay, now this can happen and that can happen. I have no idea the stakes or what's even going on. But it's also like visually striking and kind of the characters are great and it's subverting some aspects of the initial narrative that don't work as well now. Like the whole, like, you are the one and all the other people aren't even humans and you can just kill them, which makes me much more uncomfortable now watching it. The part where they go in the badass like lobby scene in the first movie where they kill all the cops. I'm kind of like, those were just people. I mean, yeah, they're in the Matrix, but like they were living their lives, man, and you guys just killed them and I just didn't even make a big deal out of it. Which, you know, whatever, 20 years later plays a little differently. So I do like that the second and third movies kind of take that apart a little bit and say, you know, you're not really the chosen one. Like there are a bunch of chosen ones and this whole thing is kind of bullshit. And actually, so I'll watch a little more of it. It's definitely been entertaining. Really briefly, the most recent episode of Barry, there's one episode of this season left, was totally wild. This show is like really good. Sarah Goldberg, who plays Sally, the actress, she's this aspiring actress. I mentioned her last time I talked about this. She is incredible. On this most recent episode, she does this like long take monologue that is unbelievable. Like where it's like, she's playing such a thankless role. She's this like really insecure wannabe actress in Hollywood who it's just such a type of role, and that's so not fun to play, and it has all these meta layers for her, I'm sure, also as a, you know, I'd never heard
actual
of her
actual actress
show.
Yeah.
And like, and it's about her frustration with not getting the part and how easy it is for Barry, and like, fuck, it was amazing. Like I was just like staring at the screen like, oh my gosh, like a minute into this, like I don't know how long it was, like 5 minute unbroken monologue, I was like, geez, this is serious. And so it's just become an amazing and interesting show and I'm psyched for the finale. So Barry,
cool, good. Maybe I'll finally watch it.
It's good. It's it's a trip. Anyway, last thing I've started watching, totally unexpectedly, is Full Metal Alchemist Brotherhood.
Great.
Have you watched Full Metal Alchemist?
I haven't. I watched the original show, like most humans, and I enjoyed
it.
The end of the original show is really friggin' weird, and everyone knows that because they finished the manga later and they had to write an ending. Gita wrote a whole article about how Game of Thrones is in the same situation as this, where the original Full Metal Alchemist had to write the end of the show before the books were done, and then later there was this other Full Metal Alchemist, the one you're watching, that came out later after the manga was done and they could just make the actual show the way it's supposed to end. But it's interesting because like the original show introduces all the characters and concepts like way better in those initial seasons, and those seasons are super strong, and then the ending like doesn't make any goddamn sense at all because they had to like come up with something and it's bad and
that's
illogical.
So interesting.
But
so
yeah,
I Googled which one should I watch.
Right. And of course,
and
people said
consensus was completely like, don't even bother with the first one. Like, there's five seasons of Brotherhood, and that's because that one is the most directly based on the manga.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting, though, because usually people will at least say, like, the first couple seasons mm-hmm. of the original one are still really good. And, like, no one has managed to come up with, like, a watch order that, like, works so that you could watch.
Yeah, I basically made the call. I was like, look, all right, I don't even know if I'm going to like this show. I'm just going to start with, there's a, whatever, 50, 60, 75 or something episodes of this. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to start and see how it is. First off, it's awesome. I'm really into it. I think it's, like, it's way better than I was expecting. It, like, vastly exceeded my expectations and is super cool. The reason I started watching it was, and I'll link this in show notes, is there was this Hello Future Me, which is a YouTube channel that I don't know anything about, and it was in my recommended algo bar, which has gotten
better
lately.
YouTube's recommended algorithm can always be trusted to give you
know, it's
good
funny,
things.
I worry about my algorithm all the time, speaking of your data. Like, I try to never click on, like, angry gamer
of
videos,
course,
because the minute you click on one of those,
the end of you.
Right, then all you've got is, like, oh, the microtransactions. It's like, okay, I don't like microtransactions either, but I don't need 75 videos about it. Mm-hmm. But I've been watching a lot more music YouTube and a lot more music stuff, and that's almost as a way to, like, make my algorithm better. And so then I get recommended all these, what Bach was really doing with this chorale or something. And it's cool. I'm like, oh, I want to watch that. Nice. That is relevant to my interests.
I should get into Bach YouTubers. That sounds like it'd be really good for me mentally.
They're out there, and they're pretty fun to watch.
Cool.
So this, I don't know what it was that recommended this. This was a video about hard magic in Sanderson's Laws of Magic. Have you heard of this at all?
I mean, I can guess what it is, like, as in the fantasy books? Or
yeah, Brandon Sanderson, like, he is a Hugo Award-winning writer of the Cosmere universe, which I don't know those books. But yeah, he's a pretty well-known fantasy writer. So this video basically was about Avatar The Last Airbender, which is what pulled me in, my beloved Avatar The Last Airbender, mm-hmm. Full Metal Alchemist, and Harry Potter, and other, and sort of like judging magic along a hard to soft spectrum. Mm-hmm. And actually it relates sort of to The Matrix too, where, like, with The Matrix, it's very soft magic, if you can call it magic, because things just happen. Like, people just get new abilities and then new things show up and they're like, oh yeah, these are vampires, because, like, vampires are from old code, and I don't know, this guy can fight really well because he's, like, a program, and Neo now can do this thing, and now The Matrix follows him outside in the real world. Like, it's just constantly changing.
Yeah.
And then Avatar, which, like, one of the things I love about Avatar, of the many things that I love about it, is it's such a sturdy show on multiple levels, sturdy narratively, like, really sturdy. And the mm-hmm. lore is super sturdy. They follow these rules, this guy's Sanderson's rules. Like, the first one is your ability to solve a problem with magic is directly proportional to your audience's understanding of the magic, which I think is, like, a great rule. If your audience doesn't understand what's going to happen, you can't just have magic fix the thing, because mm-hmm. then they'll be like, well, what the fuck? I didn't even know that could happen. It needs to be exciting for them to be like, I could have thought of that. Of course, they came up with this ingenious thing. Mm-hmm. And so I like that one, you know, or, like, another one is that limitations are more important than powers. So mm-hmm. limitations are kind of the things that define you. His example is, like, Superman has powers, he can fly, he's super strong, but, like, that's not that interesting. But Kryptonite is interesting because Kryptonite is, like, from his home planet, and kind of, like, gets at his whole story and explains, like, what makes him weak. So that's just, like, a storytelling thing. Some of this stuff in this video actually is, like, from the perspective of, like, how to write a good story, which I actually find a kind of weird angle, because mm-hmm. I guarantee that most people watching it don't write stories. I never liked the advice style of criticism, but it was still a cool video. And watching it, basically this guy is like, so the way that the alchemy works in Full Metal Alchemy is, like, this whole, like, the mm-hmm. rule of sort of equal, you know, you have to give and take, and everything has to work a certain way. And they explain it really well. And I started watching it, and I was like, oh, this is really cool. I really
sounds
like
a cool show.
Yeah, because I do like that, and I like that about Avatar too.
Yeah.
Anyway, I started watching it and was ultra into it. I mean, mm-hmm. holy crap! Like, the
it's great,
second,
and the way magic works in that series is really cool.
Really,
and, like,
cool.
Just a great idea that I would never have thought of it. I don't know how anyone came up with it, but it's wild and really cool.
Yeah, it reminds me of those Rothfuss books, which I actually don't mm-hmm. like The Wise Man's Fear.
I don't
Fear.
Either. I read them, and I don't like them either.
One day maybe we can have a conversation. I was actually just playing with some of my Destiny friends last night, and those came
people
up, and I was like,
I love those books. I have to be real careful about what I say.
I know, me too. But I was like, do I need to read a book about how the most awesome dude ever was awesome again? Like, that's basically...
I think there's also a thing where musicians, like, have their own feelings about those books, because the way music is presented in them is, mm-hmm. like, so fanish,
I know,
and, like,
it's like
not
music,
the way music is.
I'm kind of here for that. Oh man, okay, we're just gonna talk about it for a second.
Whatever,
it's fine.
Yeah.
It's fine. We can talk about The Name of the Wind. This is The Name of the Wind by Patrick Rothfuss. Is that his name?
Yes,
Patrick
it is.
Rothfuss. And, like, well written, like, cool books. And I totally don't begrudge people for liking them. There were, like, specific things about them that bugged me.
Same.
I really do like some aspects of the way that this produced these books. depict music. So this guy is like, the main character is basically just the most awesome dude ever. And that's actually my main gripe, is I'm like, I'm not that interested
he's
in the most awesome.
He's great at everything he tries. Genius like, he's guy. He's like the stereotype of a Mary Sue character. Like every, he has some problems in life, but he's so clever, he can just find a way out of seemingly all of them.
And every arc is basically, well, how is he going to get out of this one? And then he does somehow. But he's like the greatest lute player who ever lived.
I know.
And clearly,
like, he plays the lute and people are like losing their goddamn minds.
They like
hearing
die
him, they
and
start
cry
crying. And like, oh, if he can only manage to get his hands on a lute, then people will just fall over in front of him at
like,
his skills.
There's definitely, I mean, so it seems like the author's probably a musician, and there's this element of like music fanfic and wish fulfillment of just like, what if I could just be that incredible?
I know,
which is like
yeah.
cool and fun in a cheap thrills way. There's this sequence where he's in the woods and he like learns to play the, he just plays the lute alone with the with the animals for like a whole chapter, and it's so ridiculous, but it's also kind of fun. There, the music actually isn't at the heart of my gripes.
Me either. It's just one of many things about the book. I more have issues with like the main female character in that book, who I think is named Denna. I might be misremembering. It's something like that.
That sounds
and she's she's the lengthy will they, won't they romance of those books. And it's always like, oh, the one thing he can't figure out is this woman who doesn't seem that into him, but at times does. And like, it's one of the main overarching storylines in the books. And like, she just never seemed like a person to me. She always seems just like this weird like amalgamation of like interactions that you might have with a woman who's not interested in you but is like kind of flirtatious with you. And like she, her life always seems so much more interesting than the main characters. Like, she often has to use her sexuality to like get out of horrible situations, and then the main character will like hear about it and be like, oh, my precious sweet Denna had to use her sexuality in this horrific way, I can't believe she's had to do this. And I'm like, really? Because I want to read about that shit. Like, Denna's like fucking figuring things out and like doing courtly intrigue and like making a living in this like fake ass medieval world where women don't have rights. Like, sure, fine, it's based on like our assumptions about what the medieval world was like, okay, but like her life always seems so much more interesting, and we just get all these little pieces of it through the lens of the main character watching her and lusting after her and wanting to have her, basically. And like, she's a free spirit and is seemingly not interested, and you know it's gonna end with them together, and that just isn't something I'm personally interested in. So I was fundamentally frustrated by those books, but mostly the loot stuff. All the loot stuff, I was like,
you're like,
this
oh my god, with
this
the loot.
How being a musician is.
Yeah, I started
great,
to feel a little
but...
embarrassed by it. I'm like, look, I love music. Like, professionally at this point, I love music, but like, I feel
great.
A little embarrassed by how much this book loves music. Like, no one should love
so
music.
So much. And it's like, the much. Way that people react to music is. Anyway. Also, there's a part where the main character like sleeps with a sexy elf at one point, and that's usually the part that people cite as going too far for them. Do you remember that plot line?
I think I've forgotten some of these books. I think I stopped reading the second one. He starts telling a story, and then it was just this endless sequence of him telling a story within a story. And I was like, I don't care.
You may have bailed before he slept with the elf, but there's like this elf who symbolizes like the pinnacle of hotness, and he like manages to sleep with her. It's great.
This is like
it's
the
great
like
story.
The fox, like the fox sequence in The Magicians. It's the like, are you in or are you out part
of
this
it's book. I just usually I see people say like, I liked the book up until that sexy elf bit, and I'm like, I'm sorry. I don't know why I kept reading it. I just did.
If you're a listener and you love those books, like,
we're
sorry we don't like them, and I totally get liking them. There's a lot of things
I totally get
like
liking
them
too, and I also think Patrick Rothfuss is a good writer. Like, there's definitely turns of phrase in there that I think are good, and like, probably
and
what
concepts.
Kept me reading is wanting to know what would happen. It's more just that I feel like the most interesting character in the book is that love interest, and the books aren't about her. So that's
problem. And you know, like, one of the things that's cool is the concept of magic. It's funny.
Yes.
What got us on this tangent is the magic in that book is cool, and it is kind of alchemical. It feels a little like similar to Full Metal Alchemist, where you go and there's a very carefully controlled, like, I think government run thing. And
although
you learn
I do
your...
feel like that book still runs into some issues where sometimes the main character can just seem to find a way to make magic work, even when I'm like, would it work that way? But it is a very like technically devised form of magic, which I think is fun. And there were parts of the book that I really liked for that reason, just from like it's a lot of data about how magic works, and that can be very fun to read.
Yeah, which is fun. And I think more and more like about it's like somewhere on the spectrum of hard to soft magic. I had never really thought about that before. I'm now fascinated by categorizing all of the magic systems that I'm sort of familiar with.
You're gonna start making YouTube videos you think?
Almost, no. But I do want to, well, maybe we could talk about it more on the show later. Like The Witcher versus Dragon Age, like versus, you know, Harry Potter versus mm-hmm. Star Wars versus The Matrix, like all of these different major properties that I've been watching and how things work in them all. And that is very interesting. And so I like that video, and that I'm glad the video got me to watch Full Metal Alchemist, because I'm realizing, I think maybe it's just as the older I get, I like this stuff more, but like the more really well explained and consistent magic systems, those are really cool. So
they
anyways,
cool.
Full Metal Alchemist, it's better than The Name of the Wind.
It is conclusion. Great. I think most people will agree with us about that, even if they're sad yeah. that we don't like that book. Books.
Nice. So let's do our music pick before we wrap up. So music pick of the week is I picked a tune by Billie Eilish, who I've been listening to lately. I'm sure everybody knows her. She is super famous and apparently like the hotness right now. Mm-hmm. This is a song called When the Party's Over from her new album, which is called When We Fall Asleep, Where Do We Go? And I guess I want to talk about her a little bit. Let's just listen to a clip of this song, which I think is really beautiful. So here's a clip of When the Party's Over by Billie Eilish.
My shirt to stop you bleeding, but nothing ever stops you leaving. Quiet when I'm coming home and I'm on my own. I could lie, say I like it like that, like it like that.
So this song in particular makes me think of that Imogen Heap song, Hide and Seek. It's beautifully arranged. The vocals on this recording. So this record was produced by Billie Eilish and her brother, who goes by Phineas, who was an actor who was on Glee, apparently. I'm forgetting his full name. But so it's like and she's like 17 years old. And
yeah,
he's,
yeah,
I don't
yeah.
think, much older than she is. Like, these are kids making this stuff. This album is awesome sounding and really, it's really distinct. It's like, I'm trying to come up with words for it, and it's kind of like ASMR Xanax, mm-hmm. like sadness pop sort of.
She has a lot of like whispery sounds yeah. when she's singing, and like just affected sounds. Yeah, mm-hmm. It's a way of singing that's very distinct.
It's very close mic'd. She is so close to the mic that I think the first track on the album is her taking out her Invisalign before she sings, and it's like this gross sound kind of.
Great.
But you can hear, I was listening to it on headphones, you can hear like, you know, her like glottal movement and stuff as she's singing. Like, she's mic'd so hot and so close, mm-hmm. and it really gives you the impression of, especially on this tune, on When the Party's Over, at the beginning, it's almost all vocals. And then it's the super Sparrow-like electronica production mm-hmm. with some pretty cool shit. And then her aesthetic is kind of Marilyn Manson, actually. Does
uh-huh.
that?
Yeah.
Am I coming out of nowhere
with
that?
I mean, it's Marilyn Manson, but for teenagers who didn't grow up with Marilyn
right. no,
Manson
yeah, yeah, yeah.
and have
it's,
no
it's,
idea that that's even a similarity.
Exactly.
But yeah, she
exactly.
does, like, her music videos have this very, like, sort of horror movie vibe. I mm-hmm. guess it's whatever the version is of glam goth for our generation
right.
is
right.
whatever the kids are calling it now. I don't know, but that's kind of her style.
Yeah, I wonder if kids who watch her, who literally, you know, I'm so much older than people,
I know,
like
right?
who, her age, it's just ridiculous. Like, if they know of Marilyn Manson, because even there's that one song, Bury a Friend, with that mm-hmm. kind of like, da-doom-da-doom-da, and it really reminds me of The Beautiful People. Like, the
yes.
groove even sounds like that Marilyn Manson song.
Yeah, I mean, mm-hmm. you know what?
And,
it's a classic.
Yeah, it's a classic. And I know it really from playing drums in Rock Band to that song. But man, she's cool. Like, these kind of, like, whenever a really young pop star or like singer comes up, or rapper, and like, you know, it's always interesting to look at what, you know, when I was 17 mm-hmm. like I was like I think back to when I was 17, I'm like, okay, so when you're 17, you're not fully prepared to do all of this stuff.
But every now and then people are like super good at coming up with shit. Like, I think Fiona
yeah.
Apple was the person who wrote her first record when she was super young as well, and like those
mm-hmm.
songs have
she
such
was.
A teenage vibe to them, but mm-hmm. it feels really raw and mm-hmm. great. And so,
or Lord is a good
yeah,
example. I think
yeah,
Lord is
Lord's
the one
another
everybody compares Billie Eilish
yeah,
to.
And so it's kind of fun when a teenager
yeah.
is able to like put those, you know, sad, horny lyrics to a really
right.
good song. I
Absolutely.
Mean, I hope her life turns out okay. It's also really hard to be in the industry when you're that young,
mm-hmm.
but I don't know. She's working with her brother, so maybe things are okay. Maybe she's not working with some creepy producer.
I totally agree about that, though. I like that they're working together and making this stuff together. I feel
nice.
I don't know, like working with my sister would have been really cool, especially at that age when you are very vulnerable and her music is very vulnerable and, you know, very real. So she's tapping into somewhere really dark in a lot of the stuff, which, you know, 17-year-old tapping into really dark stuff to communicate these truths to the world is, that's a lot.
Yeah, but then
you know?
Also, so, like, going number one on iTunes or whatever, or maybe not number one, but she's, like, been very popular.
Really big,
very quickly. So that's always kind of stressful, too.
Yeah, but so it's nice to know that she and her brother are kind of doing it together. But anyways, I think she's cool. I listened to it on a whim, just someone was talking about it. I was like, okay, I've heard this name enough times, I'm going to check it out. Really, I, like, liked the whole album. I was like, wow, this is a fucking cool album, so.
Yeah, she seems cool to me, too. I just like her music videos. They're really weird. And I like to see what the kids are into. I guess I'll also mention, like, I mentioned this to you, but there's this really funny, like, since Billie Eilish has such a distinctive musical style, like, of course, it's ripe for parodies. And Ava Victor, who's Ava and Harriet on Twitter, like, made a really, really funny parody of her, of Billie Eilish that is, like, an original song that she wrote, I guess, called When the Fire's Happening. And it's herself, like, having lit a pan on fire in her kitchen and then singing, like, a Billie Eilish-esque overdramatic song about the fire. And it's really fucking funny and people should watch it. That's all.
Nice.
But it's, like, you can only parody someone if they have this extremely distinct style, which, for better or for worse, Billie Eilish definitely does. And I don't know, this is just a funny thing to parody. It's very of the moment. So
it's funny. I hadn't watched any of her videos and had just listened to the album and had one take on it. And of course, it's very dark and, you know, it has that whole thing. But watching the videos, man, the video for When the Party's Over, it's just her and she's singing and then she drinks this like black, blue, like goo. And then it starts coming out of her eyes and it's like all over her face while she's singing. And I was like, whoa, what is happening? It was a very different, I mean, now I associate that with the song, but actually when I heard it, I didn't have any visual associations. And then the Bury a Friend video is like a horror movie and has all this kind of body horror stuff. She's got the video thing happening too.
Yeah, it's great.
Billie Eilish, man.
Music. Pretty cool.
Music. It's pretty good. All right. Well, that is our latest episode, I think. I think we're pretty much done.
I think so. This is our podcast about fantasy novels and
about
music.
Fantasy novels and privacy and Billie Eilish.
Cool.
Welcome to Kotaku
Split
Screen. Good show. So Jason and I will be back next week to wrap up Game of Thrones. God help us. We're going to get this one across the finish line. It's been fun. And Maddie, I guess I will talk to you in a week.
Yeah,
and
you will.
Until then, have a good weekend.
You too.
Kotaku Split Screen is an official podcast of Kotaku.com. It's produced by Kirk Hamilton, Jason Schreier, and me, Maddie Myers. Kirk edits and mixes the podcast and also wrote and performed our theme song and other music. We're a part of the Fusion Podcast Network, where Mandana Mofidi is executive producer of audio. You can find us on popular podcast services like Panoply, NPR One, Google Play, and Apple Podcasts. And we hope you'll leave us a review if you like what you hear. Find old episodes at kotaku.com/splitscreen. Email us at splitscreen@kotaku.com.